Thanks very much, everyone, for coming, because it's really late and you've all been at work all day, so it's really fantastic that you've all come here. And we've come tonight to talk about the Health and Social Care Act, and we've been very lucky that we've got Lucy Reynolds to talk about it, to illuminate some of the rather obscure parts of the Act. I think this Act is very clever, it's very comprehensive, it leaves no stone of the NHS unturned that isn't used to bring privatisation into the NHS. And I look at things that happened, I think, how has this happened? How could this be? And so that's hopefully some of these things that Lucy will be able to answer this evening. Lucy's a health policy analyst at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she's got a particular interest in privatisation of health and other public services. So she'll be able to explain to us the intricacies of how the Act works and how it's having part great swathes of the NHS are being sold off to the highest bidder. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Good evening. It's good to see you all. I was asked to do some teaching around this because I've spent the last year and a half really studying this this past Act and also what's going on with the NHS. Prior to that, I was working in the health policy area and on health financing. I've got a background in financial services and also running medical services abroad with MSF, so I'm a manager from that side of things. I'm qualified in the finance area. But until this, I've never had anything to do with the NHS except as a patient. As an unusually informed patient, I have been extremely grateful for the NHS. It has traditionally been run on the cheapest and most rational lines of running a health service. It is associated with very high quality and safe delivery of services and with rational care. So I have felt confident over the years that should I be taken ill overseas, all I needed to do was get one of my colleagues to stabilise my condition, get me on a plane back to London, and then the NHS would sort it out. Highly qualified doctors who had incentives to do nothing other than make me well as fast as possible and free of charge to me. It's an extraordinary thing, and if you've lived in countries where health systems have been marketised, one can appreciate just how wonderful it is. So, about a year and a half ago, it came to my attention through a video link from The Guardian to the health service lobbying tour by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. It's a short video starring Dr. Jackie Davis, BMA fame, talking about what was going on with the NHS, and this was completely news to me, and I was very worried by it. So because I've got a legal and finance background, I thought, well, there's a new health bill, I'll read it. And I read it, and that freaked me out completely. And since then, I have been very, very worried, because I really had no idea prior to that that the NHS was under attack, let alone that it was on the verge of complete privatisation. But what I saw when I read that bill, and I understand a lot of health people have tried to read it, and they generally can't make much sense out of it. It makes sense on some terms. It makes sense as a collection of writings by corporate lawyers from different industries associated with healthcare. It doesn't really read very much like a traditional healthcare bill. It does read like a shopping list from industry. So since then, I have been a bit obsessed with the entire business and have been looking into the detail of the history of this reform, so where it's come from and the logic behind it and where it's actually taking us to. And it has been very noticeable that the line from the government and the Department of Health, which should have been providing a commentary on this, it's been very much nothing to see here, move along, really. And you get a lot of, oh, it's just the same as Labour was doing, it's nothing really. And there'll be lots and lots of choice for everybody and a distinct dearth of detail. I think particularly the information coming to GPs has been very bad. I've seen advisory documents which really make a lot of platitudes about how lovely it will be that we do service planning so much better, and then glossing over what commissioning actually is. It's a contracting job. It's a legal job writing contracts and then monitoring and managing contracts. But I think that there's been quite a lot of Department of Health statements that to the effect that it's something entirely different from what it is. and we're coming really quite close up to CCG authorisation. And still, there's no proper information among GPs, and a couple of weeks ago, the GPs were told that they weren't going to have their minimum practice income guarantee any longer. In other words, the financing of GP practices is being destabilised in the same way as foundation trusts have been destabilised. Kicked out as a kind of set of independent financial entities in such a way that they can collapse financially. So there's been a lot of changes set up, but there doesn't seem to be all that much understanding among the general populace of what those changes amount to and where they come from. And I think that's probably deliberate. And therefore it becomes necessary for us to try and share information among ourselves to clarify what exactly is happening and why. Because I think anybody who works in health services and anybody who's a heavy user of health services has by this time comprehended there's an awful lot of destruction. SHA is going, PCT is going, mass redundancies. And yet the future remains a little bit shapeless and fuzzy. So, Carol has kindly collected up a number of questions, which I can see very much what the interest is in those specific questions, and we will go in on to that. But first of all, I wanted to understand from you how you see the overview of this, and then for me maybe to put into a few sentences how it would appear from outside and from the length of the reform, from comparison with the international situation, what exactly is going on and why. So would anybody care to suggest what exactly is happening, what is the transition we're seeing right at the moment?
I'm Andrew, I'm a hospital pediatrician. And I have a dubious honour being in the management sphere temporarily as well as medical. It seems to me that the bill has been extremely cunning. The act rather has been very cunning. It is allowed fault lines to appear. And the reforms from Ken Clark in 1979 to the end of the Labour government seem to be a bit of a straight line, and there doesn't seem to be much difference. But there's a definite inflection from Lansley onwards. And, you know, dabbling in treatment centres 8-9 years ago seems small fry compared to what we're currently witnessing. It's just stepping up. And it seems to me that everything is being allowed to sink or swim. And obviously if it sinks, it's to be acquired. And that is just... we can see it all over, we can see it in South East London, we can see other bits of London other than North and East seem to be seeing a lot more of the fault lines widening a lot more faster than just here, per se. But I think it's all coming to us soon from North and East London. But the scariest thing for me is the idea that the commissioning and the provision will be under the same house. And that's what scares me absolutely rigid. And I don't know how quickly it will infect the whole system. I don't think there are areas where it's other areas of the country where it's iffy because the CCGs have not been strong and are going to fail quickly. And there are areas where the CCGs are probably a lot stronger and may not fail. So I suppose my question to you is, which is the bigger problem? Is it the combining of the commissioning and the provision under the same for-profit provider, or is it the allowing the providers big and small to fail and the sort of feeding frenzy of takeovers and amalgamations? Which do you think is the bigger problem, which we think is going to have the biggest impact and wake the public up the fastest, and I suppose the other thing is if we have change of government, can we back a government on the right intention to back a repeal act and stick the images back together. Because that's the ultimate mechanical. I would pass the point of no return. Or if there was a change of government, could you actually stick it back together?
Okay, thank you.
That's
thoughtful contribution. That's framed in terms of a destruction. I see a construction behind it, and the construction is what I want to communicate more than anything.
Yes. Just to let you know, I'm a local GP, but I'm also a board member of my local GPG. They were going for authorisation at our visit next week, so it's looking caught up very much into this. And I was also responsible for procurement. So this is something that's been very much in my mind. And I suppose I agree that this you know, start off with Ken Clark, I believe he was in the back of the train, and he said the way to solve the problems in the health service is to pit generalist primary care against secondary care, because unless we divide them, we can't rule them. And that apparently was a conversation they had in the first class compartment. I don't know if you paid for first class or not. but we've definitely moved, and I think, and I might feel that it's, the health social care bill, I think, is just about one thing, and it's part of the ethos of the coalition, or particularly of the Conservative Party, which is about marketisation. They have a strong belief that markets are the way you produce efficient products, and they see health as being a product. So I believe this whole thing is purely about marketisation. And my fear is that the next step that we're going to see very soon is about individual giving patients the money, because that seems a truly, for them, it seems a truly democratic way of proceeding. And then patients will have patient budgets and they'll be buying their own healthcare. And that really will be into a true market.
Okay, thank you.
That's a construction. The construction of a healthcare market.
Yes, I think I'll engage with from that point of view and then come back to the earlier perspectives. As regards beliefs in this, if I were you, I'd be a little bit chary about believing anybody believes anything. You know, there's a convenient set of arguments that happen to play into particular people's hands, and then they say, well, this is my ideological belief that markets solve every problem, it's just coincidental I happen to have large interests in that area. So I think we should be a little bit careful about the terms about belief. It's awfully easy to dress these things up as beliefs, and there's a whole logic behind it and a whole justification out of the discipline of neoliberal economics, which it magics away, for example, people that don't have purchasing power. And the whole thing is predicated on the idea that selling things into the market is the goal, and that it is right for things to be allocated according to who's got most purchasing power. Now that is a model for delivering health services on a universal basis and taking a public health approach to things is completely hopeless. But this government has adopted that way of looking at things, and there's a set of ideologies that go with it. But they do always tend to produce the same set of winners. So I just wanted to make the idea of beliefs of to look at interests rather than beliefs. So I find cui bono is a very, very useful question to be asking. You know, it's very easy for silver town politicians to come out with all kinds of lovely sounding arguments. If you notice where the money's moving from and where it's moving to, maybe that tells a true story. In terms of the time span, I think this link with Alan Clark is interesting. Ken Clark is interesting, and I'd like to know more about that. But at this point, we're not seeing primary care and secondary care being pitched against each other. We're seeing something rather different. I'm very interested in researching further about the origins of this. But it is clear that there is a bunch of documents released in the late 1980s by the Adam Smith Institute and by John Redwood, Oliver Letwin, David Willetts, and a couple of other Tory thinkers. And they are really quite specific about what is going to happen to the NHS and what are the preliminary steps that are necessary to move to that point. And there is a whole set of goals behind the purpose of this transition. So what we actually can see now is that this has gradually been put in place. Through the New Labour years, they did the kind of background stuff that was less contentious. rearranging the legal and financial structures so as to harmonise them in time for when a government of a different stripe came in and could go for it, which is what we're seeing in the kind of Lansley days at the moment. What actually the purpose of this is replicated in a number of different countries around the world. In fact, it's gone through in most countries by now. Africa and Latin America were done in the 80s and early 90s. The Eastern European countries round about the same time. At the moment, a lot of Western Europe is being done in the same kind of way. We're seeing health service after health service going through privatisation. And what this amounts to, really, is that big business has got into some mature markets. In a mature economic market, they don't make much money, and they're looking for easy profit opportunities. And the kind of outsourcers and transnationals that are interested in this kind of work have a big preference for public budgets, really, because it's easier than getting out there and actually making their money in a proper market. What they do is to try to look for public budgets where they can persuade officials to let them in on easy terms. And so during the New Labour years, we had the independent treatment centres and this kind of thing. And what that was an attempt to kind of bring private medicine in to get a share. But actually, where that failed to take off was because actually they can't really compete properly against a decent public sector service, because they've got to pay their investors, and that, you know, they've got all the marketing spend, and they've got higher borrowing costs, and this and that. So actually, private sector cannot really fairly compete against the public sector. And having observed that after several attempts to really bring them in on very, very cushy terms, and they still can't actually compete. What is happening now is that the public providers are being abolished in order to make way for the private providers to move in. Because the NHS has been sufficiently effective at kind of, when there was a straight up competition, the private sector didn't really win what it wanted to. So now the system is being put under an extreme attack. And we're moving more directly into what the Adam Smith Institute has been promoting fairly extensively since the late 1980s, which is a shift to a system where the public sector doesn't provide, because private sector providers can do that, because they'd like to, and where the primary care level and the cost controls in the system will be handled largely by private health insurance companies. So, where it talked about more money coming into the system in the white paper, there were some comments about bringing more money into the system from the private sector, but they weren't specified in any kind of way. And I think a lot of people seem to think that that was going to be an altruistic donation from big companies or some strange thing like that, or maybe from Bill Gates, I don't know. But actually what it means is that less money is going to come from taxpayers and more out of people's pockets through the insurance industry. So the idea is that if the threat is made for me to feel more personally that I can't rely on the NHS through a communal system, then I'd better buy myself some insurance. And that is more money coming into healthcare. When they talk about that, that's the aim of it. So overall what we're seeing is a rejigging of the entire system from a state where we have a mutual social compact that we will pool resources as a nation and use that money to pay for a decent healthcare service for us all, to a model where the taxpayer is still paying, but the public sector doesn't do any of the delivery. They contract the private sector to do whatever's necessary. And that we will move away from the universal promise of healthcare to a limited guarantee from government, topped up by our own efforts, because that's seen as bringing more money into the system, which for the new beneficiaries of that, which will be the private healthcare industry, is better. They want more money brought into the system. And the reason we're not getting any sense out of the government through this is because if the public knows about it and the medical profession knows about it, there will be such a lack of cooperation that they couldn't bring it through. So what they're hoping to do is to confuse everybody and string along GPs by telling them lovely things about empowerment until it's basically too late. And then, well, you know, final beneficiaries will have got theirs, and it'll be like the railways. So the changes that are coming to the system, they have a unifying theme to them. It's not a bunch of weird, disparate things. they are all have a common thrust to them. Firstly, of getting the private healthcare industry to get more of the share it wants, and then of reorganising everything so as to facilitate that into a more or less complete takeover. So I can talk about the various what's going to happen at the various different levels of the system, but that's the general principle. What we have here is a resource grab. External parties, largely international or transnational companies rather than people within the UK, to the extent that it's people within the UK, it's kind of the usual business lobby, really. There is a push from financial services because you might have noticed stories about banks and private equity companies and different kinds of middlemen and consultants and so forth are all quite heavily involved in that. So they are involved with it as well. But there is also just an international push to open up all public budgets for involvement of more private sector entities. And that is not something that is intended to benefit Britain. It's intended to benefit the commercial interests that are coming in. They have put a lot of pressure through our politicians over the years. And they've done a great selling job, really. Now, it seems that people actually, a lot of them actually believe, for example, that privatisation is going to produce cheaper services. Now, somebody that's worked in privatisation and against privatisation, and somebody that's got qualifications in finance, I find this a very peculiar statement, really. You know, you do a job, and you either do it with no profit or you do it with a profit on top. Obviously, the first one's going to be cheaper. And the only way they can say that privatisation is cheaper is by appeal to a bunch of economic models, which are all of them based on completely unrealistic assumptions. So this economic kind of hocus pocus is the only advantage that actually exists. And for the rest of it, well, we've seen the examples of privatisation. My water bills are phenomenally high compared to what they used to be. The water still comes out of the tap, but I seem to be paying about 10 times as much for it, and I personally can't see that as an improvement. And as for what's happened to railway services, well, I know British Rail wasn't great, but if it had been funded properly, maybe it would have been. We seem to be paying a lot more now for really pretty shabby services. And there's no fair argument that this is actually going to improve the NHS. What we're getting is a lot of corporate disinformation. So does that make sense as an overview? Are there any questions on that?
Just in terms of just softening up, I think the public. I mean, we just for those who watch commercial television, you can just see. Just think about it. The introduction of adverts for private health insurance, which are now pretty well every slot. There is something about old Jim likes to go after his animals and blah 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 from Google or whatever, and it seems to be completely normal and acceptable. You know, and you talk to sort of worried middle class neighbours about what it would be like from their model, having the stories of poor care from down the country, and the way the media portrays it in the breakfast television model, the news at 10, wallowing in stories, which are obviously bad stories of bad care, but they are, on the grand scheme of things, a very small percentage of a lot of good stories which aren't told. And so from the independent treatment centres right on, it's getting the public used to the idea that it's not this social contract anymore, but we're all going to look after each other. And that's pervasive, and I can't imagine that that's very easy to turn around.
It's not.
Without fighting World War or having some other cataclysmic sort of unifying experience.
It's a big problem. And, you know, if you think about those stories, there are an awful lot of slamming the NHS stories out there at the moment. The most interesting thing about them is that in a normal country, the Department of Health is attempting to produce a good healthcare service, so if bad stories come out about the public health service it runs, it defends it. But that's not what's happening in the current coverage, you know? So all these slamming stories about the NHS, and somehow the DH is in there kicking it harder than anybody else. It's very peculiar, really, when you think about it. It's a spin campaign. You know, we are being they've got the garden path, really, yes. What was going on in New Labour, through the New Labour years, there's an awful lot of things that had to be put into place in order for a private healthcare takeover to happen. if you've got a classic public sector system, which is built the way a big firm organises itself, you've got a command and control hierarchy and people in departments and management structures and people do what they're told, and it's an internally homogeneous unit. You can't easily privatise a thing that size. So you need to make sure that it marketises internally. You fragment it into little bits, and then it's much easier for the private sector to come in and pick the bits it wants. It's a kind of divide and rule strategy. You get far less good value for things because you're not centralising your procurement. The whole thing's been fragmented into tiny little units. And now we've got a situation where our hospitals are made to go off independent. We see this week that the NHS as a whole is in surplus. The SHAs are turning a surplus which has been given back to the Treasury. And yet somehow our hospitals, especially the ones with lovely shiny new premises paid for on PFIs, somehow those are being labelled as unsustainable providers ready to be privatised. So this is all really very peculiar because there's no reason to have fragmented them in the first place. And people are buying into this, you know. The South London Healthcare Trust is producing a great stream of documents showing about, oh yes, this is really broke. Actually, why is it made independent in the first place? It's completely artificial, and the only point is to make it easy pickings. So there's been a lot of false narrative over the years, unfortunately. A lot of things about, oh, the private sector is more efficient. And it's very odd the Department of Health talking about that as well, because actually, the private sector may or may not be more efficient than the public sector, but what is rather more important is that they have different goals that they're being efficient at. You know, generally the NHS people I meet are attempting, if I'm the patient, to make me better. I go to a private hospital, that's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to maximise the amount of money I leave behind me. And it's a different set of goals. To be very effective and efficient at extracting money from your customers is a different thing from being very efficient at actually achieving good healthcare outcomes. But the Department of Health has been keen to mix these two categories up together. So that's the overview, really. It's kind of heist. And I can talk about what's happening at the different levels of the system. I did have some diagrams, which we aren't able to show you because of no projector, but I can draw parts of them and I can send them on if that's useful. Generally, what is happening is this. At the moment, we have an arrangement where taxpayer payers all contribute, not just income taxpayers, VAT payers, and capital gains taxpayers, and inheritance taxpayers, and corporation taxpayers, stamp duty payers, and everyone. You spend some money in this economy and something goes into the NHS. They're trying to take that system away. They're trying to make it so everybody has got their own individual entitlement. Each of us will attract a subsidy, probably weighted on the basis of our age and state of health and gender and so forth. And those amounts of money will be paid into the CCGs who will buy services in the future. So previously, it used to be the NHS that bought services from outside, and then we've had an internal market brought in. So then it was parts of the NHS buying services from other parts of the NHS. And now we're moving into a mixed market arrangement. With the PCTs gone, their jobs are being outsourced to CCGs and the outsourcing, commissioning support organisations, if you like, the insurance companies and the big consultants. Accountancy firms want to take on the actual work of commissioning that the PCT used to do. So that purchasing is being moved into CCGs, and the funding to do it will be on an individualised basis. So in the same kind of way as capitation fees have previously come for each person on the practice list, there will be a bigger allocation, and that will be required to pay for not only primary care services, but also secondary care services. And those will be purchased for patients by their CCG, from the GPs or from referral services. So the CCGs will take the whole country's funding pool and deal with it in specific little pots. And the CCGs therefore operate as insurance schemes. They're effectively taking in a state-funded premium and using it to purchase services that are needed for patients to the extent that they've got money. I believe it's true that if a CCG makes a surplus, it can carry it on into the next period. It can retain that? Not clear yet. Okay. Certainly, if the CCG runs out of money, it will be very difficult for it to do anything but say, sorry, no more NHS treatment for the patients. So there's a kind of a rationing setup that has to be done. But the CCG's management is also at risk there because it's got some legal liabilities towards its patients. It's supposed to be providing service. And one has to hope that the money coming in is enough. It's going to be very necessary for CCGs to pay a great deal of attention to whether or not they can break even. Because if they can't, maybe those get outsourced as well. Maybe those get just managed by some company that wants to manage them. So that fund, that universal taxpayer funding, is being split into limited pots and then put out to CCGs, and that is what is going to have to pay for care in the future, under the control of the GPs who will prescribe and then the CCGs who will agree whether or not that those payments can be made. Is that reasonably clear? Does that sound not more or less what?
The thing I don't really understood in CCGs is what happens if there is a high demand, so in one area there's a high demand for intensive care, so there's some sort of disaster or some sort of treatment, and lots of people from a particular area have to end up going to intensive care. Will that potentially bankrupt a CCG if there's some unexpected high demand for really very expensive, necessary life-saving treatment? And one thing someone's told me is that they'll get insured against that possibility of that happening. Is that right? So CCGs will be buying insurance to cover. So they get something sort of sash out to be very
good. Just to go back a second, I agree with most of what you said, but however, it's not as if you've told the story as if it's something new. Actually, CCGs have kind of just taken on what used to be PCTs. PCTs are exactly the same. This isn't a new story of the market. This all started with the internal market. And CCGs have just continued on from that. It's not a new thing. The second thing is the CCGs are actually not responsible for the whole healthcare system. And the specialised commissioning, which is the big, which is for a mild point, is a big one. Specialised commissioning is a national commissioning body, which is going to take over, for example, all intensive care, paediatrics, cardiac surgery,
whatever they find.
It depends what has been defined as specialised commission, and they're taking more and more bits away from the CCGs actually. CCGs are becoming less powerful in terms of their commissioning role. And my particular one is actually what you're doing is massively splitting it up, but your specialised commissioning is centralising huge areas, which, because I hear what you're saying about splitting it up and so you have to cherry pick little bits, but actually the little bits are not worthwhile for big companies to take. They're too small potatoes. But specialised commissioning, say specialised commissioning takes over all cardiac surgery, and then they have a nice little, very resource-rich area that is ripe to then go to the market. And actually, specialised commissioning is the area that I work in that's going to be particularly dangerous in this drive to the market.
It depends who it's going to be dangerous for. Because
dangerous for those of us who believe in the national.
There's something which hasn't come out yet, and this is what I want to alert you to more than anything.
I have the other view that the specialist commissioning for rare and uncommon things, let's say, especially which I know about neonatal, that the fear has always been that the CCGs wouldn't be able, because it's something that can't be ever happened.
Well, that's why we have nothing to do.
So therefore, it was really important that we felt it was important that lots of things that we wanted to make sure could continue will be specialist commissioning.
Right, these both tackle the thing that's been exposed to some degree, which is privatisation of secondary care. The CCG is going to be required to run two parallel competitive markets. One is the AQP, any willing provider process, which you're calling choose and book at the moment, and the other is competitive tendering. And so that will be used to put all hospital care and all secondary care referral services out to mixed markets sooner or later. That's the goal. And so what we're going to get there is people put through a service which basically favours big corporations. I did a study on commissioning about who gets the contracts and who performs well. Well, who performs well is small local organisations, by and large, private sector, charity sector, or public sector. And who gets those contracts is the big companies that have got the tendering departments, because you have to put together a stack of paperwork of that thick, and it has to be all correct. So basically, the kind of organisations that deliver services well do not have staff sitting about to do that kind of thing.
Is there anything that can be done on exactly that point? The fact that the people that perform well don't get tenders, what's the main...
There's a way to write the contracts that can make that better, and Care MP are in the process of preparing something on that. So push them, and we'll get something out. So that is a problem of hospital provision, because the aim is to basically drive NHS hospitals to use this situation to destabilise them financially, so more and more of them become unsustainable providers, and the private sector can have the bits it wants. The rest will be just turned over to redevelopment. McKinsey's recommending getting basically two-thirds of NHS land back into the land markets. So a lot of it is an attempt just to NHS facilities off its land so the government can sell the land. The thing that hasn't been explained at all is the privatisation of primary care. So that other thing is about how to privatise secondary care. But it has not been discussed how primary care will be privatised, and that is what I wanted to communicate to you. Because there is also a problem for CCGs. CCGs are to a degree a transitional state as a kind of a universal provision. The intention is to squeeze CCGs down market, to reduce their funding to the point where they're producing what is in the German situation, which McKinsey is using, appears to be using as a model for the situation here. Kind of residual poor basket of services for people who can't afford any insurance. So how do we get from what's happening now, where everything except for the specialist stuff, so basically about three quarters of the money is supposed to be going through CCGs, how do we get from that to a situation where CCGs are just doing a little residual role and the private health insurance industry has actually taken over? Well, it works like this. Those private personal health budgets, the individual allocations that are going to come into the CCGs to pay for primary and secondary care on an insurance basis, whereby the CCG will have everybody's pool. Most people will spend nothing in the year because they don't get ill, and then you'll have a few patients who are going to get very ill and be very expensive, and so the pool from everybody will have to be used to pay for the really expensive ones. So if you get a couple of £1,000 per patient, and you've got a few patients whose treatment is costing in the tens of thousands or the hundreds of thousands or even the millions, which I understand happens fairly frequently, that pool is going to pay for it. The problem is that these budgets are set up to be transferable. They're not like the social care budgets, where they can be cashed up for the patients and spent on a dog or iPod or aromatherapy or those kinds of things. They're only transferable between CCGs and other nominated destination by patient. The identity of the latter has not been explained in recent documentation, but it is explained in the earlier documentation. So either patients can transfer it from their CCG to another CCG, which they like better because it will give them better services, or more luxurious services, or some stuff like that. Or they have the option to transfer it to meet up with their top-up insurance. This deluge of top-up health insurance, NHS top-up insurance, a product we didn't have until very recently, this is not in any way coincidental. They're trying to sign up as many people for this top-up idea as possible. And then those people will be told, the ones that are accepted for insurance, which means people in good health, because if you're in bad health and you apply for health insurance, they just turn you down, they're not interested, you're going to cost money. So the people that are reasonably healthy, that were affluent enough to buy health insurance, will be invited to switch their personal health budget out of their CCG into their insurance company. And as things stand at the moment, there is nothing to stop the insurance company, for example, saying, oh, well, you can have a free gym membership if you do that. And that would be cost-effective for everybody, you know? The patient gets a gym membership, and their insurance is a bit cheaper, so if they're a fan of insurance, then they think that's good. They're probably wrong, but anyway. The insurance company gets a higher income than the incentive it paid out for. The gym wins. So the only people that are out of equity are the CCGs. And what are the CCGs losing? They're losing patients who wouldn't have cost them anything to treat because they're the healthiest ones, and they're losing a little portion of their funding.
Now, if that happens to any great extent, you're already rationing in some parts of the country. I'm hearing stories about people who've got cataracts going in and being told, oh, sorry, the NHS will only pay for one eye. I mean, I would say that if we're already at that stage, there really isn't that much scope to contract further without people actually being denied things they really need. And at that point, it's going to be very interesting for many people to try and get the top-up insurance. And at that point, you get a vicious circle happening, and the funds will bleed out of CCGs quite fast once that process starts.
And you're saying that's the case now, because that's not what's
happening.
So you're saying this is the direction of travel.
Saying if there's a set of fish tank reports which are very specific, and they're very consistent over 25 years. What they are is...
This is the end game, this is the road.
This is the end game. Each one of the think tank reports has a first section which looks at the NHS as it is now and explains why it's so terribly bad.
We've moved quite a long way from...
They publish new ones every 3 to 5 years. They come out every 5 years or so. And the first half always says, oh, well, the NHS now is in a disaster and it's in a crisis. And here's the solution.
In cancer. There's constantly in newspapers about how bad we are. We're not. That's constantly in the newspapers. It's one of the things.
And whatever has been the latest reorganisation, how it's dreadfully unfit for purpose and the whole thing is a crunch point. And they keep making these dubious arguments, depending on what the facts are at the time, and then it's always the same prescription. And if you look at other countries across Europe, it's the same thing. There's a bunch of different rationalisations and always the same prescription. And the prescription's quite specific and quite coherent. So we can see that we have come nearly 80% of the way through already, and they're still lying about what's going to finish it. But it would be really odd if this road we've travelled so closely all this way didn't complete to its official conclusion.
So I'm conscious of it, not getting in a little bit early. I'm aware that various countries in Europe have liberated their NHS earlier and have moved to things like placement health budgets earlier. Have you got any kind of data on outcomes of things like that that could be helpful to
share
today?
The Dutch system. They had a social health insurance system, and they still have a social health insurance system, which is not like private health insurance. It's according to how much you earn is how much you contribute. But 5 years ago, they stopped their state running that scheme and allowed private health insurance companies to run it on behalf of the state. So they outsourced the running of their social insurance. They haven't gone for a full privatisation, but they privatised that. And they also introduced personal health budgets. So as far as the administration is concerned, the costs went up, public satisfaction went down, and exclusion went up immediately. So that was just the change of running. Once you let the private health industry do it instead of the state, those were the changes. As far as personal health budgets are concerned, they went for something more like our social care budgets, where the patients had a great deal of freedom to spend it on whatever they want. And of course, they discovered that a lot of patients spend it on things that weren't medical care and they had no money left. They also discovered that, not terribly surprisingly, because these people are ill, a lot of them did not have capacity to manage the budgets themselves. So if they were in really good health, mental and physical, maybe they could do it themselves. Some people had decent family members they could rely on. Other people got exploited, sometimes by complete strangers coming to kind of help them relieve themselves of this budget because they were allowed to use it to pay for carers. And then there were a bunch of unscrupulous commercial brokers that set up. Overall, the functioning was worse because previously, which has been found in the evaluations of the early pilots in this country as well, if I'm ill and the state organises something, then some administrators do that, which deal with these agencies regularly, and they understand how they work, and they've got some kind of mass clout. They can say, if you don't pull your finger out, you know, all of these contracts will be a problem. And instead of having those people to help, the patients were left all on their own. So often the suppliers didn't deliver and the patients couldn't do anything. So basically that's why the Dutch government has abolished it now. The German healthcare system. Well, it's a disastrous idea. The German healthcare system. They have privatised secondary care, and it's very expensive. They have part privatised primary care, and it's just like a residual basis of provision. The French system is very, very expensive. They've got a massive problem with supplier-induced demand on the insurance companies.
So they're the good examples, really, of health services which are successful are ones which are run publicly, because that's the most efficient way to do it, really. If you redirect the efforts of your health service away from providing needed care and to making money, well, you don't manage to provide needed care as well. It's simple, really. Shall I go through the specifics?
Oh, I don't know.
Is that...
Yeah. Can I just say a brief word? I'm not a health professional, I'm a lay person, but been involved in all this for a lot of years. I happen to have been at a scrutiny meeting this evening. I don't happen because I came regularly. Everyone knows what scrutiny is. Health scrutiny. Every local authority originally was that ran social services had to have a scrutiny commission. They call it that in commission, don't mind. So they're allowed to scrutinise, and they were allowed for many years to call to order providing bodies like the PCT and call them to account and all that kind of stuff. So that's what health scrutiny is. And there are other scrutiny bodies like the crime and education and various things. So I've been going to the health scrutiny for years, and there was a report by, let's see who it is, Alice Benton, Associate Director of Primary Care Commissioning for City and Hackney, NHS NIL. And it was about, I'll be very brief, Lucy, if that's all right, it was about what's happening to the savings that have been achieved by closing down the walk-in centres at Tollgate and Springfield, and so that they've only been, they're still open at weekends, but not during the week, so they saved a couple of million or something like that. And the question I asked, by discretion of the chair, members of the public were allowed to ask questions, and they usually allow me to ask your question. I specifically asked where it says CNH estate strategy is currently being refreshed to determine the priorities for premises developments across the primary care estate. And I asked specifically, is this likely to include selling things off? And the answer was yes.
Well, that's what it means, yes.
Yes.
All
they've made no provision, that was the other question, one of the other questions I asked, for any possible costs or problems involved in terms of patients going across boundaries and maybe registering with more than one practice and all that kind of thing. They don't think they've made any.
There's been a complete failure of engagement with most of the objections about what's wrong with this. I mean, Claire Gerard at the RCGP has made a lot of fuss about conflicts of interest in the new system, because it's very plain that patients won't be able to trust their GPs any longer, because it will be, so why are you not willing to fund my treatment? What are you doing with it? Is it going, are you getting a bonus out of it? Are you trying to divert patients to your private practice? Is this, you know, the whole system of trust between patient and doctor will be damaged by it.
I'm going to have to go. My name's Annie Kubar. I'm a GP in the field. I'm head of patient participation and engagement for the CCG. I'm very interested in this meeting and sort of been involved with the bill. We've sort of fighting against the bill for a long time. If there's anything positive I can say, can you please get involved with your CCG patient participation engagement groups? Help us feedback as much as possible to try and do as much as possible to mitigate any danger we can. There's lots of stuff that I, in my heart, I believe we won't be able to do much about. I do believe we can do the best we can. I definitely have been trying to do as much as I can. I'm going to have to go. Obviously, yeah.
Also, and she brought some leaflets for your. Charlotte's got type 1 diabetes and she wants to share them, so perhaps we'll leave them Thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye. Maybe if I go through the specific questions, that might deal with those and also provide some kind of other angles in. How have GPs been stitched up? You've been stitched up, but it's a strategy which Oliver Letwin set out in 1988 for privatisations generally. There's a whole list of instructions on how you bring that in when the public doesn't want it. And one of the instructions is that you need a fifth column, and your entrepreneurial GPs are that. So that's how you've been stitched up. And also, that I think it takes people by surprise that the authorities are just not telling the truth about this. It's, I mean, it's an extraordinary situation, really. But how does the Act tie CCGs into the private sector? Well, three ways. Firstly, CCGs are required to run markets. And the point of running markets is that if delivery of healthcare services is structured as an economic activity, it falls within competition law and trade law rules. And if that happens, those rules mean that private companies have to actually acquire rights. So if all procurement is put through competitive markets, it means the corporate sector can come in and get it. So that's why you're not going to be given the opportunity of doing anything but procuring services through three ways. One is through running competitive tenders. Another is through renewing existing competitive tenders. And the third way is choosing a book, which is called AQP. Those are your options.
Can you say something about that? Choose a book.
Yeah, sure. Can I come back to that in a moment? So the way CCGs ties CCGs into the private sector. Firstly, it's required to help the private sector get into secondary care and take what it wants. They don't want to make a complete takeover, they only want the profitable bits. And they only want them for as long as they're profitable. They don't want to commit to service provision because it's not about wanting to provide services, it's about getting the money while the money's there. So they don't want to take the whole thing, they want to cherry pick. You're going to be asked to run markets for that. The second way that it ties it in is that I understand that GPs mostly have a job to do already and don't really want to take on a bunch of contract law tasks. So the thing is being set up in such a way that it will make it terribly tempting to outsource to a management consultancy or an insurance company that's offering you the service, and the NCB is offering you a budget to pay for it. It will just be made so easy to do that. So you are a funnel into basically the private sector getting a part of the budget that way. And then thirdly, there is the mechanism I was talking about just now where the money will be able to follow the patient out of a CCG and into a private insurance company. So you will be a transitional stage from PCT through CCGs, and then this competitive mechanism to suck away affluent, healthy patients into the insurance companies, leaving you with the poorer, iller ones. With a limited budget to deal with. So that's CCGs in the private sector. Why does European competition law matter? Why didn't it exist beforehand? It's existed for some time. It exists to control trade activities. If you provide healthcare services out of a pure public sector arrangement and it's not about making money for anybody, it doesn't fall within competition law. If you arrange everything so it's competitive tenders or AQP, things being paid for on a PBR, a payment by results kind of a basis, that was the switch of financing we've shifted to recently, where doctors get paid for the services they're putting out there, that all harmonises with the way the private sector wants to do things, and it pulls things into the remit of competition law. So the old way of organising things wouldn't have put you inside competition law, but Lansing in particular has worked very, very hard to make sure that all of the NHS budget will have to pass through markets which pull it into competition law rules. And they want that because under competition law, private companies get rights. Is that okay on competition law? Do I need to... Your question?
Just a quick point on the... In terms of competition, I'm very interested in that because in the NHS pathology market, which is undergoing rapid progress, in London, there's one provider called TDL, which you've probably heard of. TDL, the Doctors of Laboratory. And they're actually already controlling around maybe 40% of NHS pathology in London. And there are rumours, very strong rumours, that they're going to take on a chunk most time, which will give them maybe 60-70% of the market. So I'm actually thinking in my own, and perhaps my colleagues, whether we can make a request for investigation and office for trading and or the Competition Commission. So how do you see the situation in the future where private providers get in a position of market dominance or monopoly or develop cartels? How does that fit in the competition aspects of the
I think it would be a very, very good idea for you to pull the competition law people down on our situation. Pathology was an early example. I think North Cartridge Coles has been involved in that. And there's also big involvement from some of the big accountancy firms. They took pathology as an early example of let's privatise this. And you can see in that market the fact that actually the competition law model doesn't work. They have this, this idea based on economic theory there must be lots of providers, but we all know that actually because of economies and scale and so forth, once you set up that market, it has a tendency to consolidate into as few players as possible. And in fact, the way we're, certainly the way we're enforcing competition law at the moment does not deal with that particularly effectively, as you can see from, for example, the accountancy sector, in which there is four large firms. And since everybody's supposed to be audited, you've got a choice of one in four. Well, four is small enough to cartelise, and these models are based on, you know, basically an infinite number of providers. I think that would be a very interesting test case to take through with pathology. The whole thing's based on a pack of lies really, that's been disproven over and over again. I don't really understand why our politicians fall for it. There seems to be some very hard sell going on.
I think the attraction for NHS Trust we've gone down this route, when joint ventures, the other big one is Circuit, that's not going so well, is that they get their staff, they perceive they actually do reduce their liabilities in terms of NHS staff benefits and pensions and things like that. Although, in some cases, the NHS has been lumbered with the responsibility while the private sector has been provided with trained NHS staff at no cost or low cost.
Yes.
So I think I just want to alert everyone that this is happening. I think this company, TDL, within 6 months will probably control around 70% of NHS college services in London.
Yep.
So I know we're all concerned on clinical services about it's coming, the looming privatisation. And pathology, as you said, we've been hit first.
Mm.
And it's all on the radar. There's almost no articles in the BMJ about it, no articles in the Hearing News about it, no articles in the German press about it, hardly any. So the British public needs to somehow be alerted to that, and maybe the people in this room can help bring that to the public's attention.
Well, I'd like to know more about it, certainly. Mm. I have a question about the role of marketisation of the NHS. I think it's very important that it's phrased as marketisation. Because that way, when all different people are doing bits and pieces, it's not like the private sector being lumbered with the whole thing. There's bits they really don't want. Anything difficult, anything expensive, anything risky. They want stuff you can fill
yes,
out.
Yes, yeah.
They want hip replacements and cataract ops.
Yeah.
And they don't want anything with anybody who's actually seriously ill and complicated. So that's why it's marketisation, not full-scale privatisation, so that they can cherry-pick.
This made me think, you're saying this now, one important area which they don't seem to cover very much in the bill is the future of training for healthcare professionals. Because with you know, companies whose obligation by law is to make sure that others, training the next tranche of medical professionals is not in their interest.
Well,
For the next generation, this is going to be a complete amount of disaster.
It is, and this is not an oversight. It was me that pointed out to the Royal Colleges, why don't you seem to have a big place in this scheme? And the reason is they want to downscale. The programme on Virgin the other day explained that when Virgin took over a GP surgery, which had four GPs, they promptly got rid of three of them. And then the fourth one went on maternity leave and they sent in some locums, who sometimes weren't even there. This is standard. They want to de-skill things. They want physicians' assistants to do jobs, doctors' jobs, nurses' assistants to do nurses' jobs, and wherever possible, clerks with algorithms to do the work. Ideally, clerks with algorithms located in cheap labour countries. They don't want face-to-face interactions between patients and doctors because you can't make much money out of doing that. And also, doctors are stroppy and difficult and have principles. And you don't want those involved because it gets in the way of making money. You want the staff biddable. And so this whole business, you could see from, for example, the cosmetic implants business last year,
when it emerged that those cosmetic surgeons don't have to actually be on specialist registers. And so this was pointed out to the government, and have they done anything about it? No, the private healthcare industry is regulated less, so what we're going to do is drop NHS standards down to that. There's just going to be less training. It scares me very much, personally.
I think something else that is happening is that even within the NHS, the same pressures are applying, you know, in the same way that, say, the BBC, you know, gets its money from taxpayers, but it needs to win the ratings war, you know, although it shouldn't have to. In the NHS, the same process of de-skilling, demoting, you know, putting people down grades of agenda for change, getting rid of agenda for change, you know, all the things that the private sector will be doing and is doing, the NHS is doing too.
Earlier, so that the flat falls on the NHS, honestly. There's a very interesting levelling exercise undertaken by KPMG, I believe, which is a Department of Health document put out in 2011, and it explains how the NHS is at an advantage to the private sector, and therefore the private sector should get a cost advantage when it bids for NHS contracts. And they asked for a 14% uplift. Very interesting document, because it mentioned a whole load of things like the NHS has to do all the training, the NHS has to do all the A&E, the NHS has to do all the intensive care, blah, 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 blah. They mentioned them, but they didn't cost any of those. They only costed the ones where the advantage was against the private sector. So this came to a 14% cost advantage, and the activist Richard Grimes tackled it and managed to knock it back. So that was removed. But they won the same argument in the prison sector, and at the moment the prisons bids and the public sector ones have to be 13% cheaper than the private sector in order to beat them. And previously that was set at 21%. The private sector has the ear of our government that we appear to have lost. I'll trip through some of the others because they're good points. AQP, what is this? AQP is a, if you think of competitive tendering as a kind of wholesale arrangement, you know you're going to have 200 patients going through for a particular service in the next few years, so you organise a kind of a bulk product for them. Well, if it's complaints that you only occasionally get, then there is also a retail market, which is serviced through what the EU calls the any willing provider arrangement, where people who want to provide those services sign up and are checked to be financially solvent and not to be discriminating against people and some things like that. And then they go on a list and can be offered as public services. So we have in the NHS, the any willing provider mechanism is choose and book. It got rechristened as any qualified provider by the Future Forum, who were very adamant that it was not good that it was any willing provider and they ought to have some qualifications. So the government changed the name to any qualified provider and they said, okay, we're happy with that. There weren't any qualifications put in, just the name change.
It's what's happening with choose and book is that more and more as you open up the different choices, like urology or orthopedics or whatever. The BMI hospital is appearing at the top of the list nearly on every page, every time you ever...
It's
D.
It's D.
What's P?
It's
B. Begins with
B. Oh, B. Oh, yeah.
There was no indication that Bart's hospital calls that for a reason.
Well, it's not alphabetical, is it?
No.
No.
Possibly you can pay to be higher on the list.
That's a question for, I don't know, you might know. Who decides, well, who gets on this picking list?
No.
Is that you? Decides?
It comes centrally.
Yes. I'm sure there's people who know a lot more about choosing book than I do, but I have gathered that you have a target in the NHS called PHF 09 for this year, and that is the target for GPs to put... they're supposed to maximise the percentage of non-public sector contracts they're offering. So it is a specific Department of Health goal for GP commissioning to include more and more and more non-public sector. So that, you know, that's one of the clearer indications that this is the point of it. They don't want to announce things like that, but you can just find little telltale bits and pieces in the system which make no sense, other than as part of privatisation.
How is it different from tendering? AQP, the patient chooses. Competitive tendering, what happens is that the CCG decides that there is a need for a larger service. They put out a specification. They have to write a specification of what they want. The more detailed it is, probably the better it will work out in the long term. That needs to be advertised through the entire EU by law. And then you have to accept those bids, and then you have to screen the bids and maybe let them do presentations, and then you have to pick from the bids. You're allowed to pick on two different sets of criteria. One is a process of price competition only, and the second is a process called MEAT, most economically advantageous tender, and that is a mix of quality and price. The statement that you will not be choosing on price at all is just incorrect. There is no quality only selection. If they set tariffs, then you can say that that element of the price is taken out, but it doesn't really work overall. So,
but who decides that a full tender process has to happen?
I think
CCGs can choose which group they want to go to with advice from.
Yes, do they have to take the CSU's advice? Or can there be a local agreement within the CCG?
The CSU are.
CSU.
Well,
the commission
supported
are not our masters, they are our servants.
I've watched that relationship. You don't want it to suddenly flip with that.
As for instance, the OMC, I just got an email a few days ago. There's a practice in Enfield that's being put out to competitive tendering. Full competitive tendering advertised on the OMC website. So who's decided to do that, to go through that huge expense of doing
that's
this tendering process and then. So they're doing this before they leave.
Yeah.
They're just dismantling the NHS.
It must have been a practice that was an APMS.
That it was, yeah.
If you were an APMS, you have to go down.
They have to.
Law, have to go down.
So they can't revert to being a.
No.
Right, okay.
Only the GPs who were there at the time can choose before, whilst they're still there, they can choose to change their contract. So
yeah.
They can make a bid to change their contract, but then. It really would be rare to find any EMS practice that would do that because they're often salary doctors.
Just
clarify
EMS.
EMS. Most GPs are what's called GMS, and we're sort of just part of the NHS family, as it were. EPMS was a way to bring in private providers to provide GP services.
So it's United Health and Care UK and the practice,
yeah.
Charles and Leslie and his lot. And
yeah.
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 The entrepreneurial.
The alternative practice.
Can NHS services be involved? Yes, NHS services can bid. They're not very good at getting the bids, however, because they're difficult to produce and they require dedicated teams. And the public sector doesn't have great teams to put these things out. And of course, once a public sector organisation loses a tender, probably it's going to let all its staff go, so the next time that tender comes around, that organisation will no longer exist to give you a bid. So if you don't keep your public sector providers up, they'll have gone by the next time around. And that is probably entirely deliberate. Social enterprises. Technically, a social enterprise is where the management gets together and runs a non-profit organisation. What is being said to be a social enterprise by this government is not technically what, for example, the Social Enterprise Forum thinks is a social enterprise, because a lot of them are for-profit companies. But it's the same idea that we'll get the staff to front the bid. And it sounds great. This is where, you know, all this John Lewis business is concerned. However, when you start to actually look at what's going on, it doesn't look quite the same, and it doesn't look nearly as shiny. For a start, the big social enterprise that is always touted is the Circle model. Now, Circle is being run through quite a complicated company structure, but what it amounts to is it kind of looks like the staff is in charge, but actually they aren't. They're minority shareholders, they don't really get a say in very much. But they're out the front there, and then, you know, they can talk a good game about how this is all involving the staff, and the staff are there. There's an organisation called Central Surrey Health, which was a government poster child for this social enterprise business. And they went up for a contract which they were supposed to win because they had the most credible bid and, you know, they were the experts on it.
And they lost the bid, they lost it to a commercial organisation. Yeah, I believe it was, yes. On the grounds that they could only come up with a 3 million guarantee and Virgin could come up with a 10 million guarantee, so Virgin won. And we've seen about the different standards of care provision that those two organisations say. So basically what it is, you know, how much bankers have you got behind you to be able to put millions of guarantee? So they're not allowed to be a social enterprise just for themselves. They've got to get some bankers behind them, otherwise it's not going to fly. Also, a student of mine is involved in a social enterprise buyout from the NHS, and she told me that putting together their bid to put in a credible bid for the work they want to do, it cost 2 million. Now, that 2 million is not recoupable by any means, even if they get the contract. How many bids do you think they can afford to put in and lose? It's not really, is it? So basically, this is another kind of contract. It looks terribly shiny, but the truth is, unless you've got private bankers, unless you've got the bankers behind you, it's not going to happen. So it's just a way of putting a shiny face on privatisation again, unfortunately. I mean, you look who's actually running the circle. It's not Netflix, it's bankers. Bankers and lawyers are running it.
I'm criticising that circle because, I mean, does that also allow you to very, very good speaker. But actually, they have, Circle has a sort of the operating front, but most of their profits go into another Circle company, which is actually based in the Cayman Islands. So that's really what Circle is about. The next time you hear him speak, because he's a fantastic speaker. He convinced me every time.
He's a salesman.
He's good. But, Circle is a funny Circle.
He's an ex-Goldman Sachs banker. He talks a really, really good line. I've been pulling apart the franchise agreement. 39 pages of the 81 are blacked out. I'd asked, first of all, Gus came about it on Newsnight, and he said that he and Circle haven't had that stuff blacked out. So somebody else wanted most of that contract blacked out. So we can't really tell what's going on with it. But it does appear questionable about what happens if he manages to sell off some of the land, whether they're able to take money out from that kind of thing.
There's a whole lot of very interesting things going on in the private sector area, which is based in the Cayman.
The Cavendish Holdings is.
Yeah, the Cavendish Holdings.
But certainly, this is not going. It's not something which is intended to be building strong health services. That's not the goal.
Can I ask a question? I thought the NHS Act put the capital funds for selling of property belonging to the NHS under the Treasury's hand, not under the DOH. So even with the policy of privatising, does that actually give them the right to sell? Because I thought you're only allowed to sell for a certain percentage nationally per year under the NHS Act. Is that circumvented by this?
I think it may well be. I don't know about the old arrangements, but there was a PropCo in the new act. It was a property company set up under the control of the Secretary of State. When it was announced, the construction industry press went absolutely bananas because I started to Google that to see how they were reacting, and they're delighted with it. It represents the implementation of the McKinsey recommendations. They recommended in 2005, apparently, that 30% of A&E across London should be sold off so that the land could be redeveloped for housing. And in 2009, they made a suggestion that 65% of NHS land could in fact be repurposed for development by either shutting sites down entirely and getting rid of the services or by providing care in the community. But, you know, we all know what happened the last time Tories introduced care in the community, so I suspect it will be the same model already, shutting services and then leaving people uncareful. So, I think you'll find that that rule has changed and it's been superseded, but I can't say that for sure because I'm not aware of the original arrangement. Certainly,
but you think it's in the Health and Social Care Act?
Certainly in the Act, yes. It's around about section 300. I'm not certain of the final section because there were a lot of amendments that made the numbers jump slightly, and schedules 23 and 24 that deal with that and the staff transfers into private sector. So it's definitely in there.
I just got a bit of information here through the BMA's website. It said that NHS Property Services Limited will be a property company wholly owned by the Department of Health. The principal function of the company will be to hold and manage the estate And I think the idea is that within 3 years, this is going to float off and become its own organisation, so that NHS property will sort of just go out into the market. Something, yeah. I just wondered, it's 9:30 now, and I just wondered if we could start talking about what we can maybe do about this. Because then it's, I don't think I can barely hear anymore.
Yeah, that was an action. Is there any burning questions? Because I think I've covered most of the main ones. Is there anything that I desperately need to cover before we go on to that?
Well, Jackie's point, Jackie Davis, who I knew well, she's been a colleague for years, is that we've probably gone past the point of no return. Do you agree with that? Or do you think that if there was a government change before 2015, that we could... do you think there's an apparatus, legal apparatus, if you repeal the Act, or is it just too huge a thing to do?
It's a matter of political will rather than legal problems, I would say. My belief is that Labour may have to be dragged kicking and screaming to do the right thing because of their track record of doing the opposite. I mean, Tony Blair said lots of lovely things while he put all the preparation in for this. I don't think it's as hopeless as all that. It's not a great situation we're in here, but we can influence a number of things. We can influence the speed with which the system degrades towards its final state. We can influence what kind of services get commissioned. If commissioners specify something that looks very like the public sector service that already exists, because that's what you want, because that's meeting your needs, because that's grown up to meet your needs, actually the chance of some outsourcer coming in and trying to do it with a tenth of the workforce to make it cheaper is quite limited. If you don't specify very much, the latter is quite likely to be forced into that position. In terms of getting the thing back, I think that there may be some legal ways through. But mainly it's about whether or not whoever wins the next election is interested in serving the electorate, or whether they're interested in serving some other set of interests. That's my personal view.
Is the cost going to be astronomical?
Yes. This is a flat lie that it's going to be cheaper. The point is, we are acquiring a load of leeches. What we will do is bleed and encourage supplier-induced demand. So a lot extra medical service will be provided, because they don't care whether it's necessary care or not, as long as they get paid for it. So they will encourage overspending. So we will spend money on their bank accounts, their shareholders' bank accounts, and on paying for a load of care which doesn't help patients and in some cases damages them. And that's where we're going. So, yeah, it's going to be costly.
The price of the tendering then end up being very costly. Well.
Yes, it's expensive. Yeah.
The thing I find difficult to understand is that why did the BMA balance us on striking for pensions, but not striking against this? We all knew this was coming through.
Yes.
A lot of us objected to it, although
fifth columnist.
Much time to read much
fifth columnist, your leaders got captured.
It was apparently it was legal. We weren't allowed to ballot the strike action on.
We're only allowed to strike on terms and conditions.
That's right.
We're not allowed to strike on.
But equally, the BMA did support the campaign publicly from the time it said it was going to after the SRA.
Not until it was 2 years. 12 months earlier, you might have been able to.
There's been lots of activists, for example, Jackie Davis has been pushing very hard on the BMA, but the people at the top were not engaging.
But I felt that, personally, a lot of people felt like striking about pensions as a sort of misplaced frustration over the Health and Social Care Act. And again, it was a huge media coup against doctors that were striking to be greedy.
Whereas
actually
it was
a lot of people who were very painful.
Yes.
I think before talking about what we do with it, we have to accept that, in fact, the political situation is not quite set in stone as you make out. I mean, one example is that you talk about Letwin and the Fifth Columns. The Tories bill in 1991 actually failed miserably. The whole fund holding, the GPs that were the Fifth Columns, became isolated and exposed, the whole system did in fact break down. So it's just because it's their strategy doesn't mean to say that it was worked. We managed to undermine that to some extent, and that formed the basis of what some of the buildings and they've been committed to. I mean, not enough. And likewise, I think we have to be careful that we don't see this as being total basement in approaching it. And to do that, one point to make is you, I'm not sure you're right to say that the funding of primary care services are not under the CCG, it's directly for the National Commission. I think this is very significant, firstly because they're trying to undermine all the contract arrangements that have been for primary care. They presumably do want to hand it over to the CCGs, but there's quite a big problem and a challenge. And I think that there is a possibility that they could run into some problems with this, because what's happened in the last few weeks really has made it into even the fifth condition. So I think it's a pretty dire situation, but I don't think that there is with movements, and I think in talking about what we can do about it, we have to accept that things can be done rather than that we're just flailing in the wind.
I'd agree with that. I just want to make people understand that it is severe.
Yeah.
But it's not.
I don't think any of us would be here if we didn't agree there are been horrible threats, accelerating it for the last 10 years. I think we have to also think locally. I think there are some very possible ways in which, as a local health economy, you can actually work together. This is a strong CCG. It has the potential to work far better, although I have to say previous understandings between social care, Hackney Council, and health have been slightly fractured. I think there is real potential to build on the power of CCGs locally in developing and working with what I think we fail to recognise a lot of the time, a much more threatened social care environment, in actually saying, well, we're all beleaguered, we can work together to make this actually work far more effectively. And I think there are real possibilities to try and circumnavigate the negative aspects of the Health Bill Act, or whatever to call that. Because I think if you have a strength of view where the health economy are driving it, with the best one in the world, if you make it complicated enough, particularly with integrated services, actually private providers won't be able to tender. And that's what I think is a useful strategy for us to take forward locally.
That's exactly what we were talking about at our meeting at CCG today, which was about procurement and writing our contracts in a way that if any of you read the constitution, which seems to have managed to successfully get on the radar of the NCP. Contractors, our constitution is all about ethical and procurement, and we've written lots of sort of bits of it in there when we go into detail. But the thing is, whilst we do something locally, I think the question is whether we can do anything on a national basis. I've yet to hear whether there is anything we can do nationally.
Well, there was this case in Gloucestershire, wasn't there? Do you know the details of it, Shannon, about the patient who challenged the PCT when they were putting out services for tender?
That.
And they took it to the court, and I think they settled out of court.
They settled out of the court, but the key point is that the tender was not conducted correctly. So it's pushed it back to them saying they were going to re-tender correctly, and I believe now there's some attempt to bring it in-house. I don't know whether that's going to be able to stick. But, to be honest with you, the more people query the procedures and try and organise different things and make points in favour of patient welfare, about not just shoving it out to the private sector as fast as possible and those kinds of things, the better it is, because there'll be more public debate about it. Either you'll get away with what you want to do, or you'll be knocked back publicly, and they'll have to explain themselves. And since there is no reasonable rationalisation for any of this, that is not in terms of a commercial grab for the public sector budget, if we put them on the spot and make them explain themselves, it becomes very difficult for them because they have to lie more and more and more. Force them to explain and they will come across them really quite badly. Michael Portillo said at the beginning of this that if the parties had admitted what they were going to do, then it would never have worked. But if you look in the manifestos for the last last election, all three parties put this in coded form, meeting all three of them, pulled them apart, and you can see the traces of it. All of them were pitching on this, all three were trying to conceal it. They're very interesting, those manifestos. It's like on hell. Three different people have written a document based on the same base document. It's like their plan for all three parties was just the same. And I think it may be because they've got the same advisors.
When you say try and do something on a national scale, yeah, I mean, are there...
I mean, what I think is the only... We have conflict of interest as doctors, as things as doctors. And I think the only way to do this is for patients. And to really make sure patients are really informed about, you know, to be able to give talks like this all over the country to get patients informed and they can get out and tell others. Because I think the government find it very difficult to argue against patient power.
But
they can easily argue against conflict of interest, personal interest, or doctor's issues. They're trying to reach around because there's some scheme they've got in their mind which is going to benefit them. And that's easily solved.
But it does sound as though the CCG you're involved in is being slightly subversive, which is
unusual.
No, but isn't there a national organisation of CCGs, and can't you spread the subversion?
KOMP is going to contact different CCGs and trying to build a relationship. 38 Degrees has been using patients to try and do the same thing. So, you know, we're trying to reach out to CCGs in this kind of way. But I sort of agree. We certainly need the medical profession to understand about this. And I would like the medical profession to be a lot more aggressive on this, because it seems like commercial providers from other countries that want to run our hospitals or want to insure our people, their voices seem to get noise in opposition. Doctors seem to get shouted into silence quite easily by, say, all provider interests. Well, I can see some provider interests coming in against you, and personally more keen on you know, the doctors that have served me and my family all my life, rather than some bunch of fraudsters from another country. I don't know who they are. Probably not good. There are national organisations as well for patients and for medics. Keep Our NHS Public. Shirley and I have both been there today. Neither of us are medics, but there are plenty of medics there. So that's a kind of a joint effort to try and make a grassroots campaign across the country. There's a launch of National Health Action tomorrow, which is targeted, it came from MDs and public health doctors, and it's to be a political movement to actually address the democratic deficit around the health bill, and also as a method of awareness raising. And that's targeted at medics, at patients, at carers, at people who are integrated with the healthcare system and care about it. So really anybody who's a stakeholder in the system. And the aim of that is to bring people together on a single issue of the fact that something very, very valuable that belongs to all of us is being taken away. And we've not had no say in it, and hardly anybody in this country really thinks it's a good idea. And it's being taken. So that's a political movement around that. There are quite a lot of different grassroots efforts. The Labour Party is mobilising around this now. Some people are in doubt as to whether the Labour Party will actually deliver, or whether this is, you know, words are cheap. And it'll get them into the next election, and then they'll just renege and go along with whoever's funding them, or whatever, I don't know. But they're saying they're going to do something about it, so if you're interested in the Labour Party, then getting in there and pressing them, keeping their feet on the fire over this, that would be a good thing. So there's three things. What other things do we need going on?
Can I ask a question as a not-doctor? Why have the press been so silent over this? I mean, they have been conspicuously absent. Even The Guardian, I hasten to add here.
I can explain that. Firstly, it would appear that the media generally are a little bit short-staffed these days, and they are rather inclined to only print things when stuff is kind of delivered gift-wrapped to them. So they'll reprint your press release, but a lot of them won't do very much in the way of actual active journalism that you might think of. So the activist movement hasn't been very coordinated about getting stuff to them. But the Department of Health and its spin machine putting out all the knocking stories about the system that it's managing itself, those go out through a very impressive press machine.
And the Prime Minister himself, of course, is a PR man.
Right. And of course, the big companies who are lobbying, they've got their slick press machines. So you've got some lines of disinformation coming in from the commercial healthcare industry. They're saying, we're fantastic, we're the luxury option, but there's nothing much going on. The government is saying, move along, nothing to see here. The issues are very, very confusing and complicated. People say, what's going on with the system? And I found I'm still talking 2.5 hours later, and I still haven't entirely covered the thing. And between it all, the journalists are just like, who knows? It becomes a non-story if it's complicated enough. Also, it's about the future. People keep saying, oh, well, can you provide evidence that what you say is going to happen will happen? No, it hasn't happened yet. It's hard to provide evidence. About the things that have been made in relation to the media. I mean, the BBC, I've been saying for at least three years, has been, over the whole health and social care thing, in breach of its public service duty to inform. And I complain, I've got ridiculous letters, you know, all saying the same thing. But recently, there was something which had looked into that and confirmed what I've been saying for a long time. So I need to go back and get that bit of information and circulate that to people, because it would have been possible to make a bigger campaign about the BBC, but I wasn't, you know, I just talked about it. Nobody ever did anything, which is a real shame, because I think we could have done something about them. A couple of political things I want to say. In relation to the Labour Party, I just want to say that a few months ago I was able to get myself to a meeting of a South London Labour Party thing where Diane Abbott was speaking. And I said to her from the floor that it was very difficult to take on board what they meant when Andy Burnham said, we're going to repeal the Act. And I said, what the Labour Party needs to do is to say, here we are, the Labour Party, talking to you, the private sector. When we get into power, we're going to take back what we've got into the public sector, and we will not give you any compensation, and if we need legislation to do that, that's going to be first on our list. Now, that's something that's going to affect shareholders, and it'll be very clear, and something they can do. But she said, I will take it back. Right? So that was several months ago, and I did an email which managed to confirm that that's what she'd said, so that's in writing. You know, whether they will do anything about it, I don't know. The other thing I just wanted to say is that, I don't know whether people know, and again, KOMP is looking into this, in the Newcastle area, the local council have managed, we're checking up on this and getting the facts, but the local council managed to get into a situation where they provided a loan to the local trust, which was having PFI difficulties. So that the PFI's pitch came back in the local authority, which means the interest is less and it's out of the hands of the PFI. Now, again, looking into those, if that local council can do it, so can others. And that would be a way of trying to get, you know, a bit more of the PFI out of the system. And just about what we can do, I mean, I think it's really important that that the Labour Party is pushed, and, you know, they have to be. I just think more people ought to be joining Keep Our NHS Public, and, you know, any organisation they know ought to be joining it, affiliating it, or whatever. And if you haven't got time, it doesn't matter. The numbers matter in terms of people who are members and also your subscriptions, you know. We are trying at KRNP, and I think this is a positive thing, to raise some funds so that we can devote some really to what KRNP has done in the last few years without the support of the trade union movement by and large, and certainly without the support of the Labour Party, been absolutely phenomenal. They've done a fantastic thing, but, you know, we're now in a very dire situation and we need more money to do that, so we're looking at that. We've got a small grant to enable them to do that, and I think there are moves, but people have got to get really angry and jump up and down, and I agree about patients. You need to encourage your patients to become, you know, part of the PPGs. I'm in a local PPG. We've got a very good constitution, which means that they can do something as opposed to just being about, I mean, it's important as well, but not just being about how long it takes you to answer the phone and, you know, how long you have to wait for an appointment. It involves, you know, stuff, and so I'm circulating that constitution for PPGs to look at as well. So there are things we can do, and I think the main thing is, you know, just not
quite to lose hope yet, because there is stuff, and you know, patients are on your side, they still need galvanising an awful lot, but you know, we're right there with you.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Nick,
I mean, just to lower the tone, really, I think with all the usual and the correct methods for challenge haven't been very successful because of the welter of political and commercial pressure and the amount of money they have to throw at everything from PR to their own lawyers. So we're sort of faced and squashed by that, I think, as we go along the way and put up our pressure. But I do think there are, you know, there are areas of government weakness, and one of them is, you know, to think like a Sun journalist and to go for embarrassment and potentially legal challenges where we can find them. And I've sort of been encouraging 38 Degrees to use the money that they've raised from subscribers to pay lawyers to actually start to look at some of the areas where we might raise legal challenges. I mean, one of the obvious ones that I thought that seems to have passed everyone by and made me wonder whether I got it wrong was when Baroness Williams stood up in the Lords when all the amendments were going through, and she said that she called us, she said there have been loads of lies spread about the raising the cap on private income to 49%, and that is not in the bill, and Lansley confirmed that was not in the bill. And of course, you know, 2 or 3 months ago, they announced it was in the bill, and it's all over the papers that it is up to 49%. In fact, I don't think 49% is specified at all. Where I tried to find it in the Health and Social Care Act, and it refers to the Health Act 2009.
They were allowed to decide 100% if they wanted it. So
apparently
she's capped it at 49%, but honestly,
yeah.
I don't think it makes a lot of difference, because it's only we go to privatisation by one route versus another.
Yeah, I think it was about out. It mustn't interfere with the running of the hospital for its NHS patients, and therefore less than half would be seen not to disturb that equilibrium, I think is the logic. Anyway, so that was lost. But someone a baroness who stands up in the Lords and says it's a lie, whereas it's been shown to be something that is in the bill, surely that is misleading Parliament. And I mean, that should be a legally binding statement.
And was not coordinated with anything else and helped the bill go through when it shouldn't have done.
Yeah,
so
it was critical. It was an absolutely critical moment that she stood up and said that. Now, if we can make a big deal about what a big lie that was, that's a huge embarrassment. And if there's a legal basis to challenge it, then it is something that won't just be a day-long headline. It'll be something that is pushable through the courts. And I wonder, you know, I don't know whether that's a legal challenge.
It's not a central part of the mechanism. Yes, it was dreadful that she did all of that. And she said afterwards that she didn't even know the content of what she was saying until a few minutes before she said it. So she kind of maybe got manoeuvred a bit.
But she said it.
I know. And I'm not saying it's bad. It was disastrous that she did that. But I'm not certain that that's the key to what's going on. I've got a question about how does the hospital fail, and I would like to explain that, maybe, because that can help, perhaps. How a hospital fails is that they've all been set up into a situation where they have to break even on their own. And a lot of them have got PFI deals. I was analysing a set of accounts for Sherwood Forest NHS Trust the other day, and they are paying as much on their PFI charges each year as they're paying for pharmaceuticals. It's a very large amount of money. And so that makes it impossible for a lot of these hospitals to break even. Monitor's job is to put NHS trusts into the situation of being NHS foundation trusts, because an NHS foundation trust is a semi-privatised thing that they can say, oh, it stands on its own, oh, look, it can't make a profit, it's a failure, we'd better get some private operators in. And of course, interestingly, it's the PFI hospitals which are going to be in that situation most, because they've got this vast interest millstone around their necks. And so it's the PFI hospitals that are going to be most likely run by private sector operators, and it's the PFI hospitals that have got the nicest state-of-the-art premises all paid for by the taxpayer at enormous cost over the last few years. Now, the whole thing could have been funded from public borrowing requirement, which now is down near 0%,
and yet we understand that they've been paying 50%, 70% on these PFI deals. I mean, it's just a kind of jobs for the boys arrangement. But the upshot is that the hospitals which are lost out of the public sector into the private sector will be primarily
the
beautiful,
shiny
ones that the patients who aren't sophisticated about these things are terribly impressed by. They like smiley nurses and deep carpets and shiny stuff, and they probably don't care whether they get a physician's assistant or a physician.
So,
surely the private companies that take over those hospitals, though, won't they also be able to pay the PFI?
No,
not necessarily.
They're going to wipe the PFI debt out from
South
London.
Yeah,
we'll pay that off. Yeah.
So instead of
paying the debt off to allow the trust to continue, they'll pay the debt off and then they'll privatise.
What's more is that overall, I mean, I think Norwich is a good example of how the debt for the building for Norwich has been sold on.
Each time at a profit margin.
So the boys in the city have cashed in on Norfolk and Norwich, which presumably is paying 50-60%.
I don't know specifically on that.
But Norfolk and Norwich, the example of Norfolk and Norwich is big because it was a total PFI. It was every single bit of the hospital was replaced.
Yes.
Whereas other hospitals, I mean, parts, the New Royal London obviously is another example where it's eye-watering. But lots of other hospitals have been smaller bits of PFI, which is manageable and not as toxic as when you've got a sort of you've got no choice.
Certainly, it's fairly plain that the whole PFI business was a con from the beginning.
Police stations or schools or whatever.
Gordon Brown went and told people in the city, fantastic, risk-free, great returns. The public sector were told, well, it'll be expensive, but the private sector will carry all the risk. So you've got the two parties being told different things. And when you look at the contracts, the price is high, as if the risks were going into the private sector. But the risk all stayed within the public sector. So it was a complete rip-off. But there are some interesting things coming through now. In the 2009 QIP report by McKinsey, which is of very variable quality, but it did make one suggestion for bringing the cost down. It recommended to the government that it renegotiate the PFI. We've got a whole load of cuts based on that report. The only recommendation they've actually taken up is to sell off NHS land, which is also in that report. They don't seem to have done any of the other things, and in particular, they haven't done the PFIs. And then when I looked at the Circle franchise for Hinchinbrook Hospital, where Circle has taken over the operation of the entire shebang, so it is not, they haven't cherry-picked it, they said they'll do the whole thing. Well, in that, as I said, quite a lot of it's blacked out. But two parties are specifically protected, and they don't include patients. The two parties that are specifically protected are Circle, which has an indemnity from the public sector that they're not going to get in any loss. They haven't excluded things you can't exclude by law, but they appear to have excluded everything else. And the PFI investors. Circle are forbidden from doing anything which damages the interests of the PFI investors, which I find extremely interesting, because McKinsey say, renegotiate these debts and save money. And Circle, which is run by a team of bankers and lawyers and accountants, has been instructed they're not allowed to renegotiate those debts. So obviously whoever's made that contract thinks it's possible. And now we've got SLHT, where we're hearing, oh yes, all in debt, push it out to the private sector. And as Coral says, they're just proposing to make those PFIs vanish at the point when they've served their purpose of justifying privatising the thing. The whole thing is very dubious indeed about PFIs, and we really need to move to start challenging those PFI deals before it's too late, because the government's refusing, and it's definitely possible. And for me, that's a real weak point in the system, and I would like to see pressure applied on that one specifically.
And I brought up the point of the VMA meeting to a lawyer, and he said it's not possible to negotiate the contracts. So it's really interesting you're saying that. And I think, obviously, he's going to take a position. But I think if we can sort of make sure that if that is true, that we can advertise that as much as possible. It's in the interest of every local community to know that they can challenge and persuade a renegotiation of their local hospital PFI. So I think it will change the whole landscape.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where, yes, okay, there's a contract, but the fact is if you come up and say, sorry, we're not going to be paying this, then they'll talk.
And if it's done in the public eye, where somebody is gouging 71% off a hospital, those companies, they've got a public relations budget and an advertising budget. They have got a reputation to be dragged through the dirt.
70%
we should be dragging them through that
morally,
dirt.
Morally,
it's disgusting. Right, and these companies do not want bad publicity. They are very sensitive in that, and we should be giving it to them.
We're seeing at the moment Starbucks, you know, they're losing their reputation of being dragged through the dirt and accused of being immoral in front of public. So why can't we do this?
This is the story, isn't it? The financial story, especially in the financial crisis, is through this terrible waste of money and corruption and so on. This is the story that the journalists should be getting hold of, and it's a simpler story. It can be honed down.
The Daily Telegraph did run an investigation into this, and they're hardly a bastion of anti-government.
We've got the Mail campaigning on this, and the Mail on Sunday about the A&E closures, and they've been really great. They've pointed out that if you keep somebody travelling an extra 10 miles, 20% extra of your patients will die. You shut A&Es and it's going to hit deaths, and they've been out there and documented people who have died because their A&E has been shut.
There is a slight tension, though, because if we rewind 20 years ago, London healthcare was... London was provided with too many small healthcare providers to work effectively using newer technologies, etc. And we can see what's been done with trauma or stroke or heart. And I think we genuinely believe that these are technologies are doing a lot of good. It's been a painful process, and there are a lot of people who feel that services that were very good lost out. And there are always people that live on a watershed, and when you change the watersheds, different people are going to complain. And I think that it is difficult to justify every single A&E department, which politically couldn't merge or move 15 years ago because politically unacceptable. And I think there's a problem. It's now also mixed up that improving access to modern healthcare is now, if we stayed within the NHS, is now sort of completely mixed up with the reforms of the Act, and you can't separate the two. I mean, Chase Farm should not be an acute hospital.
Absolutely.
And shouldn't have been an acute hospital for 15 or 20 years. It didn't make any sense working in that part of North London as I have for a long time. But it's remained open because of a lot of political pressure. And now, even now, it's not even closing, despite. And it's difficult to... I mean, what's happening in West London is eye-watering, you know, 5 a.m. I'm sure that's way, way, way more than cutting than should be done. And the answer is now, it's impossible now to sort of say where it should be and to arbitrate such
a decision. I completely agree, we've got to face up to looking at those issues, but as I understand it, in West London, all the ones that are closing are not the PFI ones. So the reason to have been, so in other words, what's the basis?
Well, I don't. The way it's been done in West London, I can't say whether it's good or fair or whatever. I'm sure that there's. It seems way too many.
Can't have a conversation that you can trust with anybody about it. You can't trust who's making the decisions. Or
can I make some comments about that? I mean, I'm sure that the situation isn't really all one way, which is. I mean, the situation's probably been set up so as it is, as broad as it's long in some ways. But certainly, I would agree with the specialisation argument where it comes to, for example, children's heart surgery. Because if you're doing fiddly little sewing up of pipes, the more you do, the better you get. And you can schedule those things. But in terms of emergency, apparently the Mail on Sunday did discover a Department of Health document which admits that they know perfectly well even for their three selected serious complaints, which I think was stroke and MIs and something else.
Trauma. Major trauma.
that this specialisation argument does not apply, because the fact is too many people will die in the ambulance.
That's absolutely wrong. That's actually nonsense.
You think they didn't find this document? Do you want me to put in touch with the Germans?
I agree they find the document, but the document does not work. I mean, I sat on the Orangine board in it, I don't know if this is the wrong place to, which is to say that I sat on the NHS trauma panel, and the evidence that the reorganisation of trauma has led to more deaths, there's no evidence at all. In fact, it improved massively the care of trauma patients. And I think the stroke ones also being shown to be.
Could you send me the documentation? I'd really like to see that. That would be very helpful.
I mean,
We've got an award-winning journalist backed up by some specialist investigative journalists on NHS, so the quality is not the same as the usual for that. Certainly we know that private health organisations, the hospitals, they do not want to run A&Es because A&Es have got a very negative profile in terms of the risk, the PR risks, the legal and financial risks. You need highly skilled staff to do that. So where A&Es are being shut, we know that it plays into privatisation from at least two angles. The private sector operators want to operate where they want to operate hospitals. They want them without A&Es. And McKinsey was suggesting shutting London A&Es so as to sell the sites off. So those two things kind of come in synergy. And I know that there's all kinds of clinical arguments around it. Some of them might be right, some of them might be wrong, but I do think that at the moment we should take the whole thing with a pinch of salt, because there isn't very much indication that the Department of Health is really very concerned about patients and their welfare at all right at the moment. Most of their decisions seem to be otherwise dedicated.
The Public Act and Public Health is just like
absolutely. I mean, that's
part of them. The BMA's having a London Regional Council meeting on the 19th of December, which is a day, during the day on a Wednesday. You probably all had it in your inboxes. And that's to discuss the very thing about the reconfiguration of hospitals in London. So that's at 2 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday the 19th.
Can we have some information about that so we can take that to KOMP London and we can have a sort of picket to the BMA like we've had before?
Alison Pollock speaking, we don't want to picket her. I'm not a supporter.
Picket as a chef. Before when we've done it, we haven't been picketing against the BMA, we've been picketing for the BMA, encouraging them to come to the
BMA. That's an interesting thought.
We need the information.
Yeah.
The 19th of December.
Can the Department of Health be had up the corporate manslaughter if they are organising for accident emergency departments to close, knowing that it's going to cause an increase in deaths, if that is the case? I mean, it's not only trauma people,
I'd say it's more likely to be around public health, because the national strategies in public health are more likely to result in corporate manslaughter. But until it happens, God forbid.
The problem is you can't connect it. If a kid dies because they got sent to an urgent care centre where they got a paracetamol, sent home and then didn't make it to A&E for another few hours and they died just before they got there, you can reasonably closely connect it to the lack of A&E service. The problem with public health is that it's very hard to make the connection strong enough in law. You can do it on a population basis really easily, but on an individual basis you can't.
I think we should be using far more instruments to measure public health nationally in segments to actually reflect how changing public health, which is predictable, in the next 10 years, needs to be part of that political campaign.
I think the corporate manslaughter thing is very interesting.
I think we better wrap up. Thank you very much for coming. It's been fantastic. And,
you should all be encouraging your patient in order to support him to sign.